Good afternoon, everyone. I'm John Auerbach from the Centers for Disease Control, and I'm going to focus on a particular angle of the integration of primary care and public health, and that's what does this mean for public health? And I'm going to skip ahead to a number of slides and start by saying, as I'm doing that, that the issue of linking public health to primary care is a top issue for CDC. It's one of Dr. Frieden's three strategic directions. In thinking about that, though, it certainly is a challenge for public health to understand how best do we develop ties and connections with clinical providers and with the clinical system that reflect the changes that now exist, namely those very significant changes of dramatic increase in people with health insurance, the changes that are taking place now in with regard to payment, moving away from volume-based contracting to value-based contracting, opportunities there to pay for more on prevention and upstream healthcare services, and the shift to a greater focus on patient-centered medical homes. What we experienced with our colleagues at the local, state, and federal level in CDC is that beginning those discussions often was confusing, because what public health people mean by population health and prevention often is quite different than what might be meant by a clinical provider who's in the room, who's thinking about their patient panel and what they need to do in terms of managing an individual patient, or an insurance company that's thinking about how do we work with our members in terms of programs that are prevention-oriented. Public health people often think community-wide or population-wide. And so, again, what we were hearing again and again is we need to know not just how important it is for us to be at the table as the health system is being transformed, as health reimbursement systems are being reorganized, as some of the mergers take place of large healthcare providers. We need to be at the table. That's maybe lesson number one. Public health people need to find out what the activities are going on in the community and then determine how they can get a seat at the table. That's a challenge in and of itself. But what I'm going to focus on today is what do we do when we have that seat? How does public health show it has demonstrable benefit if it's at the table with the insurers and the healthcare providers thinking about how to participate in this period of change? And what CDC has come up with is a framework that says in order to be of value in those discussions, public health people need to be able to participate on three different levels of prevention. Three different buckets, you might say, and that we need to understand how to be concrete and specific in terms of the value that we offer. So what's the first bucket? The first bucket is understanding that public health has a key role in terms of supporting and promoting what are we might call the traditional clinical prevention interventions. That's immunizations, it's screening for diseases, it's counseling on behavior change. All of those things are critically important, and the expansion of healthcare access and the increased use of patient-centered medical homes means there's greater opportunity. But this is not a time that public health people can say, hey, those things are just going to take care of themselves because the clinical providers are paying attention to them. The information that we have is that that's just not true. We're very uneven in terms of guaranteeing that patients have access to key preventive services. We know, for example, that we've got work to do on some of the immunizations, HPV, for example. We know we have work to do on some of the screenings, colonoscopies, for example. And we know from the clinical indicators that are shown here that even when we know that there are specific clinical steps that can be taken for what Dr. Frieden refers to as the ABCs, the percentages indicate about where we are in terms of achieving those. Now, that's not because clinicians aren't doing their best job. It's not because insurers aren't paying for it. It sometimes has to do with just, it's very busy. People have 15-minute appointments. There's a lot to cover. And what we argue is public health folks can play an important role in terms of helping to increase the utilization of those preventive services. First of all, by helping to pay attention to where we are and pointing out that we're not where we should be. We're not where many clinical practices think we are. And so sharing that information that we gather from a variety of sources can be helpful. Other things that we're good at in public health is mobilizing the public to be aware of the importance of those clinical preventive services and mobilizing clinical practices and insurers to have materials that they can share with their patients, materials that remind them of the importance of paying attention to those preventive measures, because in a busy clinical day they may be pulled in many different directions. One additional way that we have worked on this at CDC is to say that we need to have in the hands of the public health practitioners, when they show up at those meetings I was talking to, evidence that's gathered about the effectiveness of traditional prevention interventions in a manner that's useful for the insurance industry and the providers. So we've developed something to demonstrate how that can be done. It's a model. You can use it if you want, or you can use the example of it to develop your own approach. But we first looked at high burden health conditions, high burden in terms of both health outcomes and cost, and we identified the six that are listed there. We then identified within those six 18 very strongly evidence-based interventions, many of which that could be provided within the traditional clinical settings and aren't now. Sometimes it's I'll give you one example. One example is looking at medications for smoking cessation, high blood pressure, and other key health conditions where we know that the control is not what it should be. What the evidence shows is that eliminating any cost sharing increases utilization. Any cost sharing at all. If it's a $10 copay, that's enough to decrease particularly the vulnerable population's utilization. So we're working actively now with insurers to say, take a look at these medications. Here's the evidence we've gathered. You want to have these controlled. It's in your best interest in terms of cost as well as health outcome. Eliminate these. So that's an example of one of the 18. So that's all included in bucket one. Oh, by the way, this campaign is known as 618 because of the six high burden conditions and then the 18 interventions that are evidence-based. The second bucket is what I call innovative patient-centered care. And there, this relates to the opportunity we have with payment reform, with value-based contracting and prospective payment, not fee-for-service payment, to pay for things that traditionally haven't been paid for in clinical settings that public health has often identified, often together with clinical providers, as good for health outcomes and cost-effective. So what are examples of those? Well, I'll give you two examples. One is we know from the data, we know from the studies, that home-based visits by community health workers and others for the families of children with moderate to severe asthma can be very effective in reducing asthma triggers in the home and reducing hospitalizations in emergency rooms. This has been studied. We have the data on this, but it's not routinely paid for by healthcare insurers. So we're now, again, this is also one of those 18. We're now working with the insurers to say, it's solid evidence. It's not a few studies. It's solid evidence. This is now something that should be routinely paid for by health insurance. By the way, that will free up public health dollars, which are now supporting many of those initiatives. Another example is some of the innovative work on hypertension, home-based care, partnerships with other providers. But the idea of thinking outside the box and pushing for clinical services that reach into the community, into the home, is part of bucket two, possible with value-based contracting. Now, bucket three is also important. For the public health, Bucket three is not, unlike bucket one and two, which is really focused on the patient and patient care around prevention, bucket three instead focuses on the community, the larger community, and how to make the conditions in the larger community such that they encourage the likelihood that people will be patient, will be healthy, and not need some of the services that are provided in the healthcare delivery system. But it also means that there will be a way of reinforcing the clinical guidance and preventive measures that are being counseled to the patients by the clinical setting. We have traditionally thought of this as something that the healthcare delivery system won't ever pay for. I think now, just as public health needs to think more about how to be supportive of clinical practices, we believe that the clinical sector needs to be more supportive of community-wide health. And there are some efforts to look into that possibility. Those include efforts in states like Oregon and Vermont that are thinking about how to design community health programs that merge together the funding that comes from multiple sources so that you don't have that separation of community approaches from clinical approaches. We're also seeing it in some of CMS's work. So CMS just proposed a hospital quality measure that for the first time would incentivize hospitals by giving them additional potential quality measures and potentially revenue if the smoking rates in the counties in which they operate goes down. Not their patients, but the counties. So those are two examples of what happened in those states and CMS that shows there's efforts to think outside the box. One third one that's an opportunity is with the Affordable Care Act's requirement that nonprofit hospitals have to work with their public health partners around developing community health needs assessments and thinking about gap filling. There's an opportunity now to draw on some of those resources from the clinical sector and engage them with the public health community in thinking about policies that work. It's been uneven in terms of the experience so far, but it's a great potential. And we have at CDC developed a few tools, including this one. It's a website that gives hospitals as well as community members best practices, recommendations, evidence that redirecting those dollars and community benefits to the community-wide approach makes sense from both a cost-effective approach and a health outcomes approach. I would close just by saying the best things that you can think of are approaches that operate in all three buckets. So what's the example of that? If you're thinking about asthma, you want the child with asthma to get an appropriate diagnosis, to be prescribed the right medications, and to have counseling from a clinician about what they can do to eliminate triggers, bucket one. Bucket two would be a home visit to the family of the child to look at whether there are triggers in the home, help to eliminate some of those triggers, and support and educate the family, the parents, as they're working to have the child become healthier. And bucket three is working on things like this. It's eliminating the triggers from a system-wide perspective, working on improving housing, working on improving air quality, both indoor and outdoor, and it's thinking about a smoking policy as being part of that as well. So again, the framework of three buckets may be helpful for public health to actively participate in a productive way as it interacts with the clinical community. Thanks.
Thanks to all of our speakers. Now, obviously, them trying to tell their stories, they've been amazingly good, given that they have long stories to tell. So we've got a series of questions that we're going to ask. I apologize, we may have very little time left for audience questions, but hopefully our speakers will be hanging around for a little bit, and if you have questions to ask each of them, or you can contact them by email. So question number one, how are affordable care organizations partnering with public health, particularly to reduce health disparities and achieve health equity by addressing preventive service needs of high-risk communities and populations?
John just nailed that.
Okay. Yeah. Does anybody want to say anything more about that? Well, then let me go to question number two.
We might have it.
You guys are good with this. I'm good with it. Moving right along. What does primary care need public health to do more of and less of to enable and sustain the integration of primary care and public health? So what does primary care need public health to do more or less of? Anybody?
Well, I guess the best analogy I could think of is sometimes this narrow gap, whatever, between primary care and public health is more like pushing a boulder uphill. But my hunch is you keep pushing the boulder, and you've seen evidence of the better integration of public health and primary care than any time I've witnessed in my career. Many of us who are physicians have very little exposure to primary care and public health during our training. It came sort of by happenstance or because of our own personal interests. So I think there has been an evolution. Is it fast enough? Probably not. But should we be in despair? No way. I think there are some very bright signs along the way.
Anybody else? John, and then I'll go to Dr. Wood.
I think one area where we need better discussions is with regard to whether or not we should be transitioning some of the safety net services that public health has historically provided clinically, STD services, TB services, immunization services, reproductive care, that have often been provided in either free clinics or in low-cost clinics by public health. I think around the country now there's a lot of discussion about whether or not we need to scale back those clinics being provided by public health, or sometimes even eliminate some if we see that the patients that have traditionally gone to those settings now have insurance and have the opportunity to go to primary care settings instead. What we're hearing, though, is that this really requires a community by community analysis of what is the need, what are the opportunities, and it really means that you've got to get at the table the public health and the primary care folks in that community to talk about how you do that, how you handle that in a way so that the patients are best served.
Thank you. Dr. Wood, you had something you wanted to say on that.
Two things. One is, I think both public health and primary care need to work better on just reaching out to each other. And that doesn't mean each person has to always take the first step, but I think there's been a bit of a barrier in some of the things that you're talking about, John. There's payment barriers there. That's the elephant in the room, and those need to be discussed to move this forward. But we've been trying to work with our docs to have them reach out to public health, and I would encourage public health to reach out, because sometimes it's a matter of taking the first step and having those crucial conversations. The other piece that we really didn't touch much on today, and I think we both have differing systems, but to really help each other, is data. Big data, small data, whatever it is, if it's individual patient data, we have issues of interoperability, we have issues of HIPAA, but that can be worked on. But those are things, I think, that could really benefit the patients in the community and the people that we serve. Difficult, not easy, but things that we're going to have to address.
Okay, let me go to another question. I apologize to both Mr. Barron and Ms. Moffitt. What does, on the other side, what does public health need primary care to do more of or less of? So I think this actually continues some of the discussion to facilitate integration of the two sectors and establish sustainable and replicable models for effective models effective in improving community health.
So
why
don't
I jump in? You jump in and then we'll go over to Mr. Barron. I'm going to go to two sides of my table.
Exactly. And actually, it builds on something that Julie just talked about, the data. We often talk about data. Public health, we're great at data. But do we use data to drive action? I think it's really the question. And is that an opportunity, and I think it is, to work with our colleagues in the clinical world? So that can be as microscopic as in the clinical setting. What do you know out of your EHR that will drive you to identify the hypertensives that aren't in control? How do you actually look at that? But it can also be hot spotting, that really target look. We talked a bit about disparities. How do you know where in the community you're not reaching, you're not engaging? And I think that also gets at what John was talking about, is really examining where do we need public health is filling the gap in the safety net, and where can we move on to other high-need areas. So I think using data, but using data to drive our action is a critical way we can partner.
Thank you. William.
Yeah, I say that primary care can really, you know, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done to kind of get the promulgate the message of how important it is for primary care physicians, the role they play in community health. You know, I think that the changes we're seeing in healthcare system are driving more toward that, but at the clinical practice level, you know, more of a focus on prevention and social determinants of health, and thinking about you know, what is driving the diseases, the conditions that they're seeing in the patients that are coming into their practice. Maybe there are things that are happening, or patterns that are out there in the community, and then really conveying to public health what those things are, so public health can then act on it. So we certainly talk about the role of public health plays in providing data so that primary care can see, you know, what's happening, but data can also come from primary care practices, including EHRs and things can help with that too.
The only thing I was going to say is
the advocacy role. I think being community advocates and champions for policy changes, you know, once they have that data, I think it's important for that to happen. I think physicians, practicing clinicians, not just for
and advocating on behalf of one another for payment kinds of issues, both for public health and for clinical. Dwight, you wanted to add something more?
Yeah, just to be polemical, I think the rap against public health, and all of us who care deeply about public health, is that we're good at describing problems, but not solving them.
Ah, we might get some feedback from the audience on that one. Okay, one more. It's good, because we're going to open this up in 2 seconds. This is a question that I think the Science Board and the Executive Board of APHA would like to solicit everybody's feedback into. To address the APHA's central challenge of creating the healthiest nation in a generation, what are the next steps or priorities for the APHA multidisciplinary membership to pursue in promoting effective integration of primary care and public health? What do we do next? How do we help make this happen? And let's start here, and then maybe we can open it up. John?
Well, I think that there are important locations where these discussions are taking place in many different states and in many different communities. So I give the one example is the CMS and State Innovation Model Grants. These are grants that CMS has given that are $1 billion in funding, 34 states, 3 territories, and the District of Columbia have these grants. Their goal is to bring all public and private payers and large providers to the table with public health inclusion and essentially redesign the health reimbursement system with new priorities and new collaborations. It's a messy process. It's a messy and complicated process, and as you might guess, it's different in every state, but it's a critically important forum for people to participate within and to monitor. And so one thing I would just say is, with STEM grants, find out what's happening, try to get at the table, try to participate. Where those don't exist, very often there's still other activities that are taking place, either at the state level or at the county or big city level.
So the STEM grants are also state, so that our affiliates, these are things that APHA affiliates could engage in.
Absolutely.
Anybody else want to weigh in on this question?
I think we've heard that payment is critical, that it's actually the economics of this. I would say there's no one thing, though. If any of us are looking for one thing, there's not. Exactly. But I do think there was another theme that came out in the presentation, and Mike actually just pulled this up, is that role of advocacy. Every one of these organizations has a position or a policy statement. We often think about, oh, that's the policy or advocacy that needs to happen in D.C. or in your state. No, it's at your school board. Mm-hmm. you know, it's at your community council. So every one of us has a role around advocacy and forming and all. And the great news is you have great expertise here on which to pull from that position statement. So I think that's an opportunity that's low-hanging fruit for each one of us to figure out where in our community do we advance policies. And that can be smoking in the community park, wherever it is that you find that opportunity.
Anybody else?
If I could just build on that a little too, for that, I think that's a critical point. But I think also APHA can be very effective at the national level and advocating for this type of policy. You know, as regulations continue to roll out around the Affordable Care Act, they're being very active in pushing this integration of primary care and public health. And I think the AMA has a strong voice on that. It's very symbolic. I'll have to say that. I think it's going to be very influential. Work with some of our organizations, strengths of your competition, that work with APHA to help us address that.
Advocacy, data, I'm hearing a lot of stuff. So let's open it to the audience and see if you want to weigh in on that question, or if you have other questions you'd like to direct to our panel. Over here.
Hi, I'm wondering to what extent your community engaging mental health and the public health trauma and exposure to violence as a significant barrier to seeking, accessing, and following up on care. And probably one of the main barriers to the ABC
Who wants to answer?
I'll start. So the integration form that we talked about, actually SAMHSA and our behavioral health partners are part of that integration piece. You'll actually see in our strategic map, we actually call out behavioral health. And you gave an excellent example with ACEs or, you know, adverse child event. I think there's important screening opportunities that we collectively, both communities, need to do.
John?
So I think that I agree with Karen. I think that I think to best address the issues that you're mentioning, I think we need a multifactorial approach. I think we need to be screening for them. But and I think that there now are there's an effort now to develop appropriate screening tools that tease out, I think, in a relatively short amount of time whether those issues exist. I think then we have to realize that when clinicians find out those issues exist, they need time to deal with it. And so if they're rushing in a 15-minute visit when they just found out something really significant, there needs to be compensation which recognizes that takes time. The other thing that I think we hear about all the time is there needs to be some place to refer the patient to where they can have that issue addressed. In a patient-centered comprehensive setting, you might have someone down the hall. You might be able to say, let me bring you down the hall and introduce you to someone, and they can talk more and get you in touch with community providers. In other settings, it means knowing who else is in the community that you can not just say to the person, here's a flyer, but that, you know, there's a way to make the handoff, you know, make the phone call, have that, you know, have a smooth transition so the patient doesn't have it on their shoulders to try to figure out, you know, where do I go and how do I follow up. And so I think that there are efforts to think about that from a reimbursement perspective and to really carve out, like, you can't solve it just by one thing. The screening doesn't solve it, you know. Or even the screening and the referral doesn't. You've got to have the referral to something that has the resources and the expertise to then provide the care. And all of that, there has to be a way to anchor all that. So I think thinking globally is really what we need, and then tackling those issues one at a time.
I saw a hand back here at the far back first, and then we'll come back over here.
A comment and then
speak up
with some knowledge. And then a suggestion. And first, thank you for this panel. This was a really great idea and a really fantastic presentation. I'm going to take some offense to Dr. Roderick's comments about public health and taking action.
I'm channeling what I hear. I agree with
maybe the perception is we've got to work a little bit more on that. But I think you do have examples in which public health has responded to, you know, emergencies that things and done a very good job. I think sometimes the political will is sometimes the problem in terms of we recognize the problem, but now we have to get the resources, you know, mounted to address it. And so I agree with you that in many cases the perception is public health care reflects a lot of information when we don't do stuff. But I think we've got to, you know, talk about those examples in which we do. The issue about, you know, data and us getting better, and I think us is about all of us in the room, in terms of getting better about more targeted data that can get us to an answer that says, here's where we really need to take action. Absolutely, I support that. And I think we've got to think more strategically about what kind of data we need to collect that really is, you know, as we talk about in surveillance, information for action. You know, where can we get the information that really drives us forward, saying, you know, you as decision makers, here's what we need to be doing about a particular problem.
Yeah. Well, let me thank you for having me. I meant to be provocative. But you know, we need resources to do our work with public health professionals. And I'm headed to Washington tomorrow to spend 2 days on the Hill lobbying for a whole bunch of stuff. And one of the things we've been trying to protect, colleagues, is the prevention cost. That's memorialized in the ACA. But when you go into a congressperson's office and you say, you know, Congress, we think the prevention fund is the way to do some innovative, you know, they just push back. So that's just a slush fund, you know, for, you know, but I'm just telling you, colleagues, you have to be sophisticated about the political headwind around this, because that's what you get. And you get the comment, you guys are good at describing problems, you can't fix anything. So just be aware that that's in the policy, that's in the legislative branch's mind, and in somewhat their DNA. On the second, firearms is one of the things you need data the most on. And because of politics, the good folks at CDC can't collect the data. Does everybody understand there's been a budgetary block on getting the data we need that can drive, you know, some action?
Let's try and take one more question from this one, ladies.
So quick question. I was interested in your opinion about the role of technology in integrating primary care with public health. There's a lot of opportunity for technology in the form of whether it's mHealth or EHR that's coming up recently. So what's your opinion on using that as one of the ways to integrate the two?
Who wants to go first?
Well, I'll jump in with one. Let's not forget the importance of telehealth and getting into rural areas and underserved areas. I think that's one that's right in front of us. It's happening. But how do we pay for it, and how do we get the experts around to make that work? But not only the technology experts, but the clinical experts are going to be part of that solution.
I think the EHRs are part of the data. It's just one data set, ways it can be broken down. But the interoperability is going to be the issue, I still think, as far as technology. Technology is there, but the way to use it is not so much, even within clinical care. And then we try to add in the piece of all the things that are going on within public health and the great information. I think geospatial mapping is something that we need to look at on the clinician side more, and how we work better with our public health colleagues there. So that's another form of technology. So I think it's definitely an issue. It's just a matter of how do we leverage it and how do we make it work better.
Any last comment?
I mean, another area where I think there's a lot of potential is in helping patients, particularly patients getting released from acute settings where we know Medicare patients get readmitted very frequently, and having the use of technology in certain things like monitoring, blood pressure monitoring, other health conditions, I think can be helpful. Yeah, and part of that technology is also the potential to communicate by computer and even old-fashioned phone, but to have that kind of a contact when there's something's happening and the patient may be isolated, but you're monitoring that so you can pass through.
It is time. I want everyone to join me thanking Dr. Hutchins for putting the panel together.